This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us Bellingham poet Jim Bertolino. His poetry has received recognition through a Book of the Month Club Poetry Fellowship, the Discovery Award, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, a Hart Crane Award from Foxfire Magazine, two Quarterly Review of Literature Book Publication Awards, and the Gene Lohman Poetry Prize for Washington State Poets. Five of Bertolino's volumes have come from publishing programs associated with Princeton University, Brown University, Cornell University, and Carnegie Mellon University. His most recent are Every Wound Has a Rhythm, 2012, World Enough Writers, and Ravenous Bliss, New and Selected Love Poems, 2014. He taught creative writing for 36 years at Cornell University, University of Cincinnati, Western Washington University, and in 2006 retired from a position as writer-in-residence at Willamette University in Oregon. In 2012, he served as judge for the California Federation of Chaparral Poets competition, and 2014 was the fifth and last year he judged poetry for the American Book Awards, sponsored by the Before Columbus Foundation in Berkeley. He grew up in Wisconsin and now lives on 5 rural acres near Bellingham, Washington, with his multi-talented wife, Anita Boyle, a dog, 1 cat, 2 parakeets, and 7 fish. Welcome to our show, Jim.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And you count those fish every day to make sure that all 7 are still there and the cat hasn't had one.
Actually, I do not, but I do look at them. And three of them are koi, and 4 of them are goldfish, and they're quite lively and beautiful.
So have they inspired some poems?
Not specifically, no, although I allude to fish, and I do have, I think, at least one poem that refers to the koi, but I don't have it with me. Otherwise, I'd be happy to quote it.
Okay. Well, I wasn't sure I was going to ask you that question, but after reading the list of who you live with, I thought I better. We go back a long way in the poetry world of Seattle and its area. And when I wrote a book called Writing Personal Essays, I solicited essays from writers I knew, and you were generous enough to send one called A Close Call, which I love, I adore to this day, and I wondered if we might start by you talking about that essay, about your early days in your writing life. I'm not sure when you wrote the essay exactly, how old you were past adolescence, which is the time of the essay. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Let me think. I'm trying to remember that essay. A Close Call. What was the close call?
Oh, well, the close call was your dad discovered that you wanted to be a poet.
Oh, that's right. Yes, indeed. Yeah, I had submitted a manuscript of poems to a publisher that I only later learned they publish your poetry at your expense. But when this manuscript came back to the house with this wonderful letter to me about wanting to publish my book, because my father has the same name as I had, the same name that I do, James, he thought it was for him, and he opened it up. And then he started reading some of the poems, and he thought they were disgusting. And I was so upset when I heard from my mother that he had done that, and he felt embarrassed that his son was a poet. I later climbed up on a high, 70-foot-high crane that at a building site, and I was going to take my own life. I was so upset.
Yeah.
But then when I'm swaying back and forth on that crane, I visualized the funeral for me. I visualized my father standing next to one of my uncles saying, he was crazy, you know, we knew he was crazy. And I thought, sure, if I kill myself, I'll prove to my dad that I was crazy.
Yeah.
So I didn't do it. I didn't jump.
And
I thought, I'm going to be a poet, and I'm going to be published. And I was then.
And you've been a prolific poet. I'm sorry that you had to get that far in your enactment to commit to poetry, but you did, and your life in poetry is so impressive, and the ending of your essay is hilarious when you're envisioning what would be said. And I think a lot of people who write poetry face that situation where people think they're crazy to dabble in poetry or think the way poets do or think poetry is even important. So Do you have anything maybe to tell us about how a life in poetry has shaped you and made you committed to the idea that not only your poems, but fostering poems in your students and in literary magazines has been really important for not only poets, but everybody?
One of the issues that I bring up, always used to bring up with my students over the many, many years I taught creative writing at various institutions, and I don't mean like a prison, I mean, you know, colleges and universities, you never get published, you never win any awards if you don't submit your work. You've got to get it out there and keep submitting, keep it going. And that was always my policy. I would not let a month go by without sending work out to magazines or to competitions, and 80% or 90% of that stuff doesn't get responded to or isn't successful, but that extra 10 or 20% can bring money your way, can bring awards your way. That's the way things have gone for me.
You focused on keeping the poetry out there.
Yes, absolutely.
How do you handle rejection, or how do you teach others to handle rejection? You said 80% of the poems don't get accepted.
Well, after I wipe the tears off my face, I just go, oh, well, I'll try this work someplace else.
Uh-huh.
That's my attitude. Yeah, you never know. I mean, you may be sending really good work out, but if it doesn't particularly hit the theme that the magazine or publisher is looking for right then, you'll get rejected. And oftentimes, the rejections come with a letter from the editor or publisher saying good things about your work. And so you keep going.
So that's what you learned, to keep going. And what about the influence, do you think, of poetry on the non-poetry world, let's say, the readership world?
The influence?
Yeah. Do you think that people beyond poets read poetry?
Oh, yes. There are a lot of people out there that if they are reading The New Yorker or something like that, and we'll turn the page and there'll be a poem there, even if they're not poets and maybe don't spend a lot of money on poetry books or something, they'll read the poem. Hmm. And people do like poetry. It has an impact. It gives them pleasure or makes them thoughtful about something.
Uh-huh. I hope so. Because I know I come from relatively the same generation as you do, and I know that my parents thought writing poetry was very frivolous.
Uh-huh.
They didn't call me crazy, but they thought it was frivolous.
I was lucky to have a very supportive mother.
Uh-huh.
My father was absolutely not supportive, but my mother, who actually had graduated valedictorian from high school, was a very literate person. She was very supportive of me sending my work out. She was always very pleased when I got published.
So having someone support you in your endeavor in that way is really, really helpful. And I think so,
yeah.
Yeah. I remember from that essay that your sister was also supportive, bringing you books before you could take them out.
That's right. You're right. That's a good point. My older sister at that time was a student at the local state college in our town in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. And because she knew I loved poetry, yeah, she would bring home books from the university library for me to look at and to read, and I didn't like them all, but some of the ones she brought home were very important to me, and mm-hmm. I felt very fortunate to have connected with that particular poet's work. And over a period of time, then, I developed a mental list, I guess, of the poets who I liked.
So would you call that early time those poets your first teachers, even though you hadn't met them in person?
The poems were instructive, yes, indeed. Uh-huh. And I was always interested in reading the biographies, I mean, the biographical notes on the books or in the magazines about these poets, and it helped me visualize what the life of poetry could be like. And,
mm-hmm.
and so that's when I began to open my mind and consider the fact that, gee, maybe I could be a professor in creative writing and stuff, which I did for a long time.
Yes, and many places. What do you think the strongest influence you may have had on other poets, besides the part about encouraging people to keep on sending their work out in your teaching, whether it's an extension of one of the people who taught you or your own invention, what do you think are some of the important things you've taught poets?
Well, it brings to mind something. When I was in the graduate program at Cornell, I was lucky enough to take a creative writing workshop with the poet A.R. Ammons, who was world-renowned at that time. And in fact, it's interesting that I've just been the current chair of the English department at Cornell is writing a book about A.R. Ammons, and just a couple days ago, I got an email from him asking if I would contribute something for his book, you know, some memory. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Ammons, A.R. Ammons, we knew him as Archie, came into our creative writing class, and he opened up the class by saying that there was a passage from a Bertolino poem that he wanted to share. It was a couple of lines from the most recent poem I had submitted to him for consideration for a class assignment. And that was just such a thrill to me. And he picked out two lines out of about a 20-line poem that were really the best things in the poem. And that taught me something as an instructor myself when we're discussing a student's poem in a workshop, is I always try to find at least a passage that is really wonderful to focus on. And I think that can be very helpful and useful to the student poet to have what the professor thinks is their best line or two discussed.
One of the things you have to learn as a poet is how to hear those lines yourself when
yes.
you're revising. And if you're taught in a way where nobody shares that with you, it's very hard to learn to do that. So it's been my experience too that it's really, really important to know that your words rang deeply for somebody, even
yeah.
if it's, like you said, a line or two lines can make all the difference. So thank you. That's a good lesson right now. And I think that you've prepared to read some of your poetry to us, and if you don't mind, this would be a good time.
Oh, wonderful. My wife printed this particular poem up as a postcard with an artwork that she did. It's been a poem of mine that's been printed and reprinted a lot of places. It's simply called To Survive. To survive, our minds must taste redwood and agate, octopi, bat, and in the bat's mouth, insect. It's hard to think like a planet. We've got to try.
Yes, and I remember that poem myself from earlier publication. It's so important, especially now with everything that's going on. It's just accelerating in terms of climate disruption and all the news we have. If we could do what your poem suggests, not only would we stay alive, I think we would keep a lot more alive on our planet rather than just worry about each day whether we're making enough money or whatever.
Before we go on, there's something I said that was not correct about that poem.
Oh.
My wife, Anita, is the one who printed this beautiful postcard, but the artwork on it is by a very famous Spokane artist, Harold Blaze, who I'm not even sure if he's alive anymore, but he's a wonderful, wonderful artist and a wonderful man.
Are the postcards still available?
Yes. I think my wife at Egress Studio Press has them available. Anybody can go online and look for Egress, E-G-R-E-S-S, Studio Press, and they will find her website.
Thank you. And, you know, while we're talking about websites, do you have a website that we should be sharing with people?
There's my main, pretty extensive website. It's just jamesbertolino.com. Poetry, there's books, there's all kinds of stuff
yeah.
on that website.
That's
kind
good.
Of fun.
I should spell Bertolino for everybody, or you should.
Okay, Bertolino, B-E-R-T-O-L-I-N-O. Bertolino. And of course, in Italian, my father was of Italian descent, the word Berto means bright, or it means appealing or attractive, bright. And Lino, of course, means line. And it's just kind of interesting. I only learned this a couple of years ago, of course, but Bertolino was a wonderful Italian name for a poet.
Absolutely. We should all look for a wonderful Italian name, pen name, if we're not lucky enough to have it, a birth name.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Sheila is talking with longtime Northwest poet and Bellingham resident Jim Bertolino about his life in poetry.
So let's get to reading some more of your poems.
Okay, here's one called Thought Chemistry. And I have a quote from a poet who is now deceased, but he was a wonderful poet about my age, and I loved him in his work. Okay, where love creates the object that it loves. Thought chemistry. As they move naked across the room, he says, think the perfect snow. Each cool flake is irrefutable, elegant as it touches their skin. Their damp pores open like mouths chanting om. The world so still, she hears the music blood plays on his eardrums.
Wow.
How?
It's a beautiful love poem, very powerful.
Well, here's one called Mouth Music.
Mm.
Okay? Given his speech encumbrance, it would not be unexpected if he described his muscular girlfriend as Amithon. She was overweight and hardly qualified as Amazon. She did favor the transparent quartz known as amethysts for her jewelry, which she kept under her bed in an odd saffron-tinted wooden cheese box. They had met as on-stage actors who'd agreed to get together off-stage, which gave birth to a lasting agreement to never marry or mar their relationship with domestic demands. She played the flute, and it had affected the way she breathed. There was always a subtle whoosh, especially when she was excited. He loved the fact they both had special mouth issues. She enjoyed noticing that strangers felt they were being mocked when he spoke. He thought it a lively jest.
And it's fun to say mouth music. Thank
yeah.
you. I want to say that we're hearing, I think, your parakeets.
Oh, you're hearing two parakeets.
Uh-huh.
Is that good for the tape?
It's fine. I just wanted to welcome them to the program as well, just so listeners know that you're not alone there.
We call them the mugwumps, and one is named Mel, and the other one is Murray. And
well,
they're both male parakeets, and they love each other. One's green and one is blue.
Okay, thank you. Well, welcome, Mel, and who's the other one? Murray.
Mel and Murray.
Right, okay. That's a good, another MM poem for you, Mouth Music, and then Mel and Murray. So how would you describe any changes in your poetry from when you began, and you began publishing early in your poetry career, till now when you retired, and I hope writing up a storm?
As a senior in high school, the teacher we had in an English class had us all write our names on tabs of paper, and she put them in a bag and shook it up, and then she passed the bag around, and we blindly had to pick out a piece of paper with someone's name, and then we had to write a poem about that person that would describe that person. Well, as it happened, the one that I picked out was for the one student in the class as a football player had already been offered a major scholarship to go play football at a university. I described him and how wonderful a person he was and how powerful and how smart he was and all that. Well, he shortly after that was interviewed by the local paper, and he gave the paper that poem, and they printed it in the interview. He didn't ask my permission to do that, but I was thrilled.
I bet.
But that was one of the things early on that kind of got me moving, that, oh, man, poetry is, well, you can get published, you know, and it was great. And then, of course, as a senior in college, because I'm somebody who thinks that you need to submit your work or apply for awards if you're ever going to get them, you know, I applied for that Book of the Monk Club College Poetry Fellowship. And this is 1970, and it was $3,000. And the idea was to give the poet enough money to live on for a year and to just write poetry for a year. And boy, between those kinds of events, I mean, I was already, as a senior in college then, I was totally committed to a life of poetry.
And did it get harder to continue writing when you were employed as a professor?
No, it didn't get harder. And one of the things that I would often do in that creative writing classes, and when I would give an assignment to write something in class, the students would write a poem in class, I would write one too. And that was a good way of keeping my momentum going. But, of course, over the years, I got to know so many other poets, and I read so many other poets, and I actually gave poetry readings with other poets from coast to coast over the years. Has always just kept things alive for me.
Mm-hmm. I always remember Kim Stafford saying in a class I took with him that as a poet, you must keep worthy company. And I think what you're telling us is part of the worthy company, maybe the largest part, are other poets and finding ways to interact with them and listen to them and have them hear you is really basic.
Kim, by the way, is very worthy company.
Yes. So I want to ask you a few more questions, but I'm wondering, since we mentioned it, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but there probably are poets and other people who would like to be poets listening, and I wonder if you could share one of your favorite assignments, the kind that you would sit down and write as well with your students.
One of the assignments, for example, is to think for a while about what would be a good line to open the poem with, a good line that would capture, through imagery and through word choices, a subject matter that could then inform the poem. And then you take that line and you modify it and use it as the last line in the poem. That assignment has worked pretty well in classes I've taught because it really gives the students a lot to think about, gets them going.
Mm-hmm. So do I understand this right, that they start out with that line and then they modify it and end with that line?
Yeah.
So it appears kind of twice.
Yeah, it appears twice, but it's the process of writing the poem, when you get the line at the end in somewhat different form, it's been changed in a sense by the process of the poem. And
right.
So it's a good way to kind of cap things off.
What makes a good line to start with?
In poetry, it's especially effective to have a visual image or a tactile image, a sense of being too hot, the sunlight off of an artwork in a room being almost this blaze of energy, or something that's visual, something that can be felt physically, maybe, or, of course, an emotion, too. Fear, a first line or something that would suggest something is really being feared. It's hard not to continue reading a poem when the first line indicates there's something really fearful, because then the reader wants to know, wants to find out. There's no reason why a poem half a page long can't have an impact on the reader that's very similar to the way, say, a good short story or a good novel would open, you know, with some image or some reference or something that catches the attention of the reader and which makes them want to read more.
No introduction, just splash in. So now you're retired, correct?
Oh, yes.
Sound blissful about that.
Well, I'm 3/4 of a century old, you know, so it's a good time to be retired.
Okay. So how do you find your writing practice now? Is it any different?
I used to use Post-its, but because they're sticky, they would get stuck to things, or they would, you know, I don't do that anymore. What I do is when I get in the mail or something, a mailer that's kind of heavy paper, like lightweight cardboard, heavy paper, not cardboard, but heavy paper, that's white on one side and has art or information on the other side, I will take my scissors and cut that up into small pieces of paper that might be about 1.5 inches wide and maybe 3 inches tall.
Uh-huh.
I have a little basket in our living room, and I have a similar container up in my study. I might have 30 or 40 of these little tabs. And whenever I have any kind of an idea, or whenever there are a couple of words or that I've just read together in a magazine or something that together could generate an idea for a poem, I write that down. I just keep these, and I keep these tabs around. But I've got a little time, I pick one of these tabs up and look at it, and I'll write something or type something if I've got the computer open. And that's one of the ways that I compose.
That's fantastic to know. So once you pick them up, where are they? They're not in that basket anymore of the blank ones.
Once I pick it up, I'll put it on the table where I might be sitting with a tablet or something, or with my journal, or next to the keyboard if I'm sitting at a computer. And that's where they sit, and I just look at them and I think about it.
Yeah, and at that point, I imagine they're kind of dissociated from when you first wrote them down. So they may be brand new ideas.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I think that's really fun. I remember reading and hearing from the short story writer, Ron Carlson, that he would do something similar, but keep it in a paper bag. And then one day his wife, he had several paper bags, and one day his wife took them to the curb for recycling. So I think a basket's better because, you know, that's pretty clear. That's something different than recycling. And then he started typing them. And what he says about them is he just numbers them and he uses them to thicken the brew. He's a short fiction writer or novelist, too. And what you're saying is they're actually sort of launching pads.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, thank you for telling us about that. I think I'll go home and or maybe I'll stop on my way home at a yard sale and get a basket. And begin, because I do just recycle those things that come in the mail. But to think to alter them to a poetic purpose would really be fun. And I think a lot of your, well, everything you've read to us today is so full of embodiment and the feeling of bodies. And I think to cut up those pieces of paper also is a body experience as opposed to just a mental experience. And it's kinetic. And I really appreciate that you've shared that. So we only have about a minute left, and I wonder if there's a parting word of wisdom you'd like to offer for people who read or write poetry, or both.
One of the things I do sometimes is I'll do a whole page of, like, little aphorisms that I make up, like a sadness that glows in the dark, or some days the clouds are blisters on the sky. Is it things that spawn poems, like the muse works in mysterious waves. His love, now dried like a fig, required more chewing.
Wow. You know, I was beginning to think of these as what if poets could have fortune cookies and these fell out of the fortune cookie.
Yeah.
That one's an interesting one to get when you're at dinner with your beloved.
Great. Yeah. That'd be a way of, a new brand name, yeah. Poetry Cookies.
Right. Well, Jim, you're retired. Maybe you have time to do that. So I just want to spend our last seconds together thanking you very, very much for all that you shared and for all the poems that you've written. I hope to get up to Bellingham soon and say hi.
Okay. Well, Sheila, you are top niche. And this has been wonderful. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.